Neil Anderson here, and welcome to part one of June 19's Ungagged podcast. We have five pieces for you, from Lawler Lundell, who talks about immigration in the UK and is titled Goodbye, You Bigoted Woman. She says, tears of Theresa May's victims should get far more attention than hers did. Mary Hunter muses on Trump's state visit to the UK. Philip Hammond's seeming lack of knowledge that there is actually poverty in the UK. And she gets enthusiastic about the Govan Hill Sistema Big Noise Orchestra. Red Ray's piece is titled Good Riddance, Mrs. May, and includes a cheerio song to her. I interview Graham Campbell. He tells us about the pre-World Cup friendly international between Scotland and Jamaica, the climate emergency, marches in Glasgow, and updates us on the ongoing processes of restorative justice in Scotland. And Deborah Torrance talks about migrant seagulls and birds near extinction, and how you should feel sorry for them before feeling sorry for a fascist getting hit with a milkshake. Music is from the Black Heart Orchestra, Petrol Girls, Ms. Mohammed, Salvation Jane, and our first track is from our featured artist for June, Bioma. Bioma is a feminist queercore band founded in 2017. The band arises from the encounter of four women from São Paulo, Brazil, carrying an intersectional feminist speech and libertarian, left-wing anarchist, anti-racist, anti-LGBT phobia, and anti-CIS systemic posture. The track on this part one pod is called Descontroller, and apologies if I haven't pronounced it correctly.
Hi, it's Deborah Torrance from Mungai. How are you all doing? The mighty milkshake, an innocuous beverage of a particular viscosity that some folk may be avert to due to the terrible stories of the dairy industry. However, there are dairy-free shakes available to make an excellent protest against terrible politicians and fascists. Let me be clear. There should be no apologies made for the creaming of the crop of brutes who quite happily spout vitriolic that endangers so many. Nor do they shy away from throwing some punches, by the way. They're pure thugs. I doubt a milkshake does as much harm as their vile hatred towards others. You will read and hear many an insightful article of why you shouldn't endorse hashtag splash the fash, but this isn't going to be one of them. This is an almighty fuck you to anybody who does meekly mumble, "Oh, that isn't right." Do you know what really isn't right? The rise of xenophobia, Islamophobia, anti-Semiticism, bigotry, misogyny, and just general intolerance of others. But the biggest concern for me is the rise of the idiot. I'm not just talking about any idiot. I'm talking of the sort of idiot who screams about chemtrails in the atmosphere but thinks climate warnings are a fallacy. I'm talking about the sort of gay person who denigrates LGBT identities because they quite like Sharon Davis or Wings Over Scotland. Two crossover demographics that never before has been twixt. A sentence that shouldn't really make any sense, a bit like a lot of the nonsense online just now. People bumping gums, so I'm going to bump mine. My friend, who happens to be a migrant, sent me a picture of a beautiful bright pink bird from her homeland, specifically marshland where she's from, and it's called the Guara Vermelho, or in Spanish it's Roja. It's a scarlet ibis. It's made bright pink by the shellfish that they feast on, and it's found in equilateral and tropical climates. Right. It's gregarious pink, enough to make Elton John blush. Alas, because of human pollution, the shellfish, which give them that unique colouring, they're being desecrated in number in their natural environments. And if this beautiful, majestic, glamorous bird loses its colour, it'll be no much more than a long-billed seagull. And seagulls, they're just pests, aren't they? Loud and obnoxious, thieves, winged vermin. But that's not exactly true. There is, in fact, no such bird as a seagull. It doesn't exist. It's a catch-all name for seabirds. In Scotland, we have herring gulls, black-headed gulls, the black-backed gull, the lesser black-backed gull, black-headed gull, common gull, kelp gulls, kittiwakes, and there's other varieties and subspecies and all the rest of it. But I often think about, what if any of these tenacious birds were bright, vibrant pink? Would the local council still use control measures to stop them nesting on rooftops and feeding opportunistically from human sources? In Scotland, we have seagulls that will mug you and even shoplift if they get a chance. However, I really admire these amazingly adaptable, bold animals. Even under persecution from human encroachment on their habitat to the desecration of coastal industry and community, their natural feeding grounds, gulls thrive everywhere. Even inland cities have booming populations. In Scotland, you're never very far away from the coast. We have the second longest coastline in Europe and an amazing variety of migrant and all-season sea wildlife. So it's no surprise you can find them in Airdrie or Rannoch. So why am I talking about seagulls when I'm clearly not really talking about seagulls? If you can find it within yourself to give an urban gull a moment of empathy after hearing how they've lost their homes due to environmental changes or lack of fishing and the nutritious waste in communities where they grew up and how now they face increasing issues with plastic in their food supply and how even when they find alternative sources of sustaining their families, they're still persecuted and even killed, then please consider giving migrant humans that same empathy. Whether it's a scruffy seagull in Buchanan Street, a bright pink guara bird on the cusp of extinction, feel sorry for a bird before feeling sorry for a fascist who spouts vile rhetoric about migrants getting splashed with a delicious milkshake.
it seems. And oh God, it's killing me. Cause I was born to live. I was born to live. I was born to live. So let's fly like birds and live our dreams. We could cause I was born to live. Not lost like me.
Hello everybody, Redwraith here. Up in the skies with my eyes on the prize. Have you missed me? I missed you, and I just dropped in to say both hello and goodbye. Hello to all you, and goodbye to greeting Teeny. Aye, a big massive, didn't you let the door hit your back on the way out to Theresa May? We have had some howlers of prime ministers, but I have to say, she's right up there with the worst of them for the amount of misery she's caused. Did I feel sorry for her when I saw all her tears? Did I hell? Sorry my language, but it's a big good riddance for me. I did write a wee song for her though. Here goes. Mrs. May, I hope you're gonna hear what people say. Mrs. May, Nina has all voted you, you have nae got a soul. Mrs. May, what do you say, Mrs. May? No today, Mrs. May. Mrs. May, I think you thought that we'd ask you to stay. Mrs. May, Nina, as we're here for you, you have nae got a soul. Mrs. May, what you say, Mrs. May? Not today, Mrs. May. Go away, Mrs. May. Ain't it us all voted you? You haven't got a soul, Mrs. May. Did you like that? Put it to music and we'll all be rich. Well, enjoy the peace before the next Egypt takes over. I mean, what can go wrong?
Politicians behaving like children. That seems extremely apt when President Trump is with us. I don't have too much to say about that, except that, you know, he's living up to expectations in every way, from his slightly bizarre dinner suit to the way he's been claiming thousands of people have been lining the streets to welcome him. And when you see the pictures, there's nobody there at all. So I think the biggest danger of Donald Trump is that he's such a clown and a buffoon that you forget he's actually president of the United States and he's got power, and he's using it in some really pretty dreadful ways. So in a sense, that kind of clownish aspect of him almost disguises how serious the problem is. He is like a child who's been put into a position where he has just incredible power, and that's really quite scary. What's scary is probably how quickly we've adjusted to the fact that he is president. We've just become accustomed to that. When if you step back and look at it, you know, it's quite an extraordinary situation that this man who is, let's be honest, an idiot, is president of the United States with access to power that's beyond most people's dreams. But hey, we just have to go on with it as best we can. The other politician who I think really struck a nerve with me this week in terms of just thinking, what? Do you actually think you're going to get away with this? Was Philip Hammond, the Chancellor of the Exchequer. And he was being interviewed about poverty. And the figure was put to him, about 14 million people across the UK living in poverty. And he actually said, well, I don't accept that. And he made a big, you know, a big play of saying, I don't accept that. I don't accept those figures. I think the interviewer had actually got things wrong and suggested that they were UN figures. They weren't UN figures. They were HMRC figures. He's the boss of HMRC. So he knows exactly how many people there are in the UK living in poverty. But he just said, I don't accept that. And he tried to say, I know there are people struggling with the cost of living, but, you know, I don't accept there are people in poverty. And there was a time when the Chancellor of Exchequer, denying the figures of the department which he's responsible for, would have had to have resigned. But we're well past the point where politicians have to resign for behaving like babies. And I don't really have much more to say than that, except I do hope we're able to move on to a slightly more grown-up place at some point fairly soon. The other thing I want to talk about, and a much more positive note, I think, and this is a very, you know, it's a very kind of local issue for me, but it's also, I think, there's a huge amount we can learn from this. And tomorrow I will be going to the 6th birthday celebration of the Sistema Big Noise Orchestra in Govan Hill. And I remember when we were first looking at whether we should ask Sistema to work in Govan Hill, going through to Ratloch to visit them there. And I wasn't completely sure that it would work in Govan Hill because Govan Hill is so diverse, but it's worked extremely well. It's been in Govan Hill for 6 years and it's been hugely successful. Four primary schools have been involved in it from the start. Now the two secondary schools, children first year, are continuing with it. We've got nursery schools involved in it. Around about 1,200 children every week are involved in playing musical instruments. We've got a fantastic orchestra. And there's been evaluations done of it, particularly by the Glasgow Centre for Population Health, showing that it's hugely successful. It helps children to concentrate, it helps them with their learning. And it's hugely successful in, you know, bringing people together, bringing the whole community together. So that's something I'm really looking forward to. And happy birthday, Sistema.
Remember when we say never again? How do we save what we know? Waiting on a sign from life. Never is a place in time. Screaming with our tongues untied. Never is a place in time. Tell the truth that we know. Hollow and dry and twisted and tired. No one has heard what we know.
waiting on the world outside. Never is a place in time. Screaming with our tongues on fire. Never will our voices turn. Coward and vile, blood on your hands, and we know we won't pretend. We said never again. Justice is served as we go, waiting on a sign from life. Never is a place in time. Screaming with our tongues untied. Never is a place in time.
Gag's resident immigrant rights correspondent. As a quick recap for new listeners, I used to be an immigrant in the UK before the hostile environment forced me to abandon my life. It's been more than 16 months since then, and I still struggle daily with severe depression and suicidal thoughts. I just want to go home, but until the immigration policies that have been enacted in order to appease quote-unquote legitimate concerns about immigration are changed, I can't. So I live in exile, unable to move forward professionally or personally, all because my daily life of going to the gym, studying, and then going to the pub afterwards was apparently too terrifying for the locals to handle. Anywho, I have chosen to live out this exiled existence in China. And recently, I turned 30. This being China, aka the land of very enthusiastic workers, as a side note, there's a reason this economy has exploded. I basically had to sell my non-existent firstborn child in order to take a week off of work. But I managed it in the end, and I was off to Indonesia for a week of volcanoes, temples, and Komodo dragons. I have a giant student loan to pay off, as I was charged non-EU fees for my master's degree, at the same time as the government talked about me as a visa-stealing cretin who was planning on becoming an illegal immigrant once I had taken all of the welfare from the hard-working British citizens. Please listen to the Lefty Life Hacks Ungagged episode from May 2018 to hear about just how terribly non-EU students are treated in the UK at present. Hilariously, I have this loan for a degree that is very UK-focused. I studied and got distinction for UK-EU relations. So gee, I don't know, perhaps you all could use some help with that at present? But no. Due to a change in immigration policies back in 2012, I and other non-EU students are no longer deemed qualified enough to live in the UK once we've handed over our obscene tuition fees. Anyways, because of this loan, my trip to Indonesia had to be done on the cheap. On the ground, that was pretty easy, I mean, it's Indonesia, but airfare was another matter. I went with AirAsia in the end, which is Asia's largest low-budget carrier. It was cheap, but it did mean that my flight took off out of Shenzhen at 3:30 in the morning. I already worked an entire day, and just kind of made my way to the airport after that and waited for a few hours. It was then a 4-hour flight to Kuala Lumpur, and another 3 hours to Java. I arrived at 11:30 in the morning, having been awake for over 26 hours. Ah, the fun of low-budget carriers. I got to the hostel and catnapped for a few hours. I then woke up and checked Twitter, without having to use a VPN like I need to in China, so that was exciting. And I groggily saw that Theresa May had resigned. Due to my fatigue, I kind of just stared at my phone for a few seconds, forcing my eyes and brain to focus a bit more in order to ensure that I was reading that correctly. But when reality set in, a grin like I haven't grinned in a while came over my face. My depression, this horrible mental health state that I've lived in for nearly a year and a half, is very much down to decisions that that woman made. To know that she was finally leaving office gave me a sense of relief and joy. I knew that her replacement won't be much better, but coming from a non-EU immigrant's perspective, they can't get worse. Starting under Theresa May's tenure as Home Secretary and continuing through today, the UK became ranked dead last of all developed countries, 38th out of 38, in terms of family reunification rights. This is partly due to the £18,600 salary requirement for British citizens to have a non-EU spouse live with them. The salary is something only 60% of British citizens make, and only 45% of British women make. This means that there are more than 15,000 children with one British parent who are not allowed to live with both of their parents, purely because the British parent doesn't make quote-unquote enough money. These people are called Skype families, because the kids and the parents can only talk to each other via video calls rather than in person. And if you think that those who do make enough are safe, then you haven't been paying attention. Aside from the over £10,000 fees that couples must pay to the Home Office, fees that were not remotely as high before 2010, these couples are still highly scrutinized. Any toe out of line? As an example, I have a friend who was able to bring his wife to the country. She's from the Philippines. And their first Christmas together, his father wired them £100 as a Christmas gift. As they have to submit their bank statements to the Home Office, this £100 gift got them in a lot of trouble, because they're technically not allowed to make any extra money outside of his and her salaries. I also know two Scottish couples whose wives are American. Both men make more than £18,600, but they are self-employed, so they were a little confused on how to fill out the paperwork, and they submitted the paperwork incorrectly. Both women were promptly deported, and the Home Office has told both couples that during the appeals processes that it's their own fault that the wives were deported. And during the appeals processes, the Home Office told both men that it was their own damn fault the wives had had to leave, and that if they really wanted to be with their families, they should just move to America, rather than bringing more immigrants to the UK. This isn't an uncommon response. I personally know two other couples that have had this happen to them. One woman has been told to move to her husband's country of Kenya, and another, whose wife and children are stuck in the Philippines, he's been told to move to the Philippines. In addition, the UK now ranks 31st out of 38 in permanent residency rights. The Tories are very open about their desires that the few immigrants they do allow to come are to be kicked out as soon as possible. As soon as the British population is trained up, they will kick out all the doctors that'll come, all the engineers, all the teachers, everybody. It doesn't matter how long somebody has lived in the country, because we are not seen as people, we are merely commodities. I knew a Canadian who worked in the office of my department at King's College who, due to budget cuts, lost her job after 8 years, and she couldn't find a new job because employers only see us as liabilities rather than as skilled workers, and she was forced to leave the country after over a decade of living there. It was painful enough for me, I can't imagine losing an entire decade of my life. Under Theresa May's 10 years as Home Secretary and then Prime Minister, the granting of permanent residency status has dropped from 154,000 in 2013 to a mere 63,000 in 2017. And need I remind you, if it's integration that people whinge about, forcing migration to be a short-term thing defeats the purpose, because why on earth would an immigrant bother embracing the local culture if they know they'll just have to abandon it? And, because of her, the country kicked me out, despite having a distinction master's degree from one of the UK's best universities in what is ostensibly a degree in Brexit. In 2012, Theresa May and her boss David Cameron took away the option for non-EU students to remain in the UK after their studies, despite the fact that fewer than 20% remained after their degrees anyways. Most students have no interest in remaining in the UK, they just come for an adventure and a degree. It was only around 17% that remained when it was an option, and since then, there has been an 81% drop in students who are able to find a visa sponsor to remain. Now only around 6,000 stay a year. 6,000 a year who are allowed to contribute the skills that they receive to the country they received them in. All while they're called every name under the sun, all while they try to not pay not only their non-EU fees off, but also pay the Home Office fees that have risen so high that sometimes the government makes an 800% profit on them. And non-EU mistreatment isn't even really covered. Sure, everyone's heard of Windrush, but even then it was in the headlines for, what, a week? It's Europeans who get all the attention, despite their treatment not being remotely as bad. And that's not to say it's not bad for them, too, because it is. This should just go to show how bad it is for everybody else. But Brexit has told the entire world that the UK is not a welcome place for foreigners at the moment. A study just came out that found that tourist numbers are down. Student numbers are technically up, but in reality those two are actually down, because those numbers are in raw terms, but only because more and more people around the world have the means to study abroad. If we look at percentage terms, the UK is losing students, because everybody is now well aware that foreigners are not welcome in the country. I have received several messages from strangers on Twitter who have told me that they've read about my situation and done research because of it, and it made them decide not to study in the UK. And I know a lot of us have this same story. A lot of us have convinced people to not go there right now. And all of this because of Theresa May, and of course her old boss David Cameron. Every one of these policies and their subsequent misery are down to her and him signing off on them. All to appease doorstep claims of quote-unquote legitimate concerns. The public's feelings that there are too many of us have resulted in very, very serious mental health problems for people who are just trying to go about their daily lives. And for some, physical dangers as well. This month, the Home Office has changed its Twitter profile to a rainbow flag, while they also actively deport gay people to countries where homosexuality is illegal. All because Theresa May heard the British public's feelings about immigration and ran amok through the fields of wheat with them. As I lay in my Indonesian hostel's bed, I watched her speech and watched her tears. I'm only human, it's not fun to see somebody cry. But I can also compare those tears to the ones I had. The day that I had to leave my home, I was at Gatwick Airport, literally collapsed onto the floor, sobbing. Not just crying, I was sobbing. Sobbing so hard that my stomach muscles hurt for days. I cried that entire 11-hour flight back to the U.S., I was barely able to leave bed for months afterwards. I still struggle with depression. I cannot imagine ever being truly happy again. I have some good days, but that's it. And it's been a year and a half of this. I just want to go home, and because of her, I can't. And there are thousands, hundreds of thousands, possibly millions of us who have similar stories. All because we weren't born on the same island as she was. And she brags about these policies. She is so proud of them. And even with it all, she also feels like she didn't go far enough. Her insistence on freedom of movement being the main sticking point of the Brexit deal proves this. She doesn't feel like she was a successful Home Secretary despite all of the pain she has caused, because she never got those numbers down to the promised tens of thousands. Now, as an aside, if the Tories would just take students out of the numbers, it would actually be damn close, but nayo, if they took students out, then who would they be able to blame NHS pressure on? Surely not them and their austerity measures. I didn't enjoy her tears, I'm not a monster, but I have no sympathy for her. And frankly, it's almost hurtful to see so many people reacting to her tears with a lot of sympathy, when they were silent about the pain of the victims of her policies. I did nothing to deserve what happened to me. I did everything that was asked of me and then some, and I still have ended up in this situation. My British friends who fell in love with non-Europeans did nothing wrong. The Canadian woman in my department who gave 10 years of taxes to the government did nothing wrong. It's all just so sad. And there's no coverage of it, and there's low sympathy. Instead, even Jeremy Corbyn, the most liberal leader Labour has had in decades, has even said that he will also fight for less immigration. And he's almost worse about it, because at least the Tories are pretty open about their, you know, xenophobic shit. Labour's sneaky. They say that they like diversity, but... Meanwhile, the Greens, Plaid Cymru, and, of course, the SNP, calls these quote-unquote legitimate concerns out for the racist thoughts that they are. They also call the main parties out for blaming immigrants for the pressures on public services that have been caused by austerity. They are the true adults in this situation, unafraid to tell the electorate that immigrants are not the devious cretins that they are often discussed to be. until adult politicians take control of Westminster, which, good luck, then I cannot foresee a near future where immigrants are treated any better. You, the British voters, need to wake up and take control and help your neighbors. Americans have flooded airports when the Muslim ban was announced, and there's been no such response for Windrush, or the foreign students accused of faking test results, or the British citizens who are forced to live apart from their spouse. Hell, there hasn't even been much in the way of mass uprising for EU citizens, who get far more attention and love from the British electorate than non-EU immigrants could ever hope for. But you must do this. Adults will not control Westminster if you do not send them there, if you do not send the message that they can't do this anymore. So wake up, take control, protest, make noise, and for God's sake, vote. As for now, and as of this recording, I must add, we don't know who her replacement is yet. You will know, but I don't know in this moment. But whoever it is, they can't be worse than her from a non-EU immigration standpoint. They can say status quo, I'm not expecting it to get better, I need a different party in charge before that's going to happen, but you can't get worse. So, goodbye. Ugh, goodbye, you just awful. Nah, you know what? I'm gonna let a Scottish man quote me out here. Goodbye, you bigoted woman.
Is politicians are behaving like children, so that is happening quite a lot. But one thing I saw that you were doing very recently and looked very interesting was at Hampden at the Jamaica Scotland Football International.
Yes, indeed.
Yes.
So, yes, I was amongst a very small Jamaican contingent, of which I probably provided about half. but no, I brought some people with me, various students from Glasgow, Caledonian, and Paisley Unis. And we managed to get quite a little group of there in front of the Royal Box. We didn't realise, though, that behind us or to the right of us, the actual Lord Provost was in that box there with Nicola Sturgeon and everything. We only found that out because when we were doing our selfies with the team manager at half time, we had Nicola Sturgeon going, you know.
Making bunny ears.
Yes, making bunny ears behind us. So she actually was. I didn't know that until after I had my photo taken. But anyway, but we were there at the game basically because several people from my area in Springbrand were wanting to come to the match. I managed to get some tickets for some families to come to the game. And it was a good learning experience for them to sort of know about the saltires and why Jamaica and Scotland are connected and tell them a bit about the reggae girls. And also good for the ones who are really interested in sport. And you know, that was quite good for girls' sport to see. Actually, it was a massive home game, really good attendance, 18,500 people. You know, there's only one other game I can think of in the entire UK that was bigger than that. And you know where that was, so I won't mention them.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was a really great day of actually really good sport and actually really good participation and just a really lovely atmosphere. And we were really welcomed as Jamaican fans by everybody there, so it was really nice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, very impressed with the women in pink were really good. Yeah. I have to say that the quality of their football was impressive. Really excellent goals scored. The best goal I've ever seen at Hampden, scored by Erin Cuthbert. Really good.
I'm not a great football person, but I went to in the Olympics 2012. Mm-hmm. We had the women's football Hampden as well, and I went to that with somebody. They had the free tickets going about, and it was USA versus somebody. And I think USA eventually won. But I thought it was fantastic. I really enjoyed it, and I think around you know men's professional football there's so much drama and histrionics that they all go through. In the women's game, they don't seem to do.
Well, there was, you know, there was razzmatazz, there's, you know, cheering for your team and all of that,
yeah.
But there's not this booing of the other side. You don't get any of that, and you don't get any of that negative vibes either. It was just lovely before the game, it was lovely during the game, and it was lovely after the game. It was just really nice. The number of people we got with selfies doing Jamaican saltire on this side, the Scottish saltire on that side, people were happy to fly both. It was just really great occasion. And what was interesting as well is the number of dads that were there with their daughters and their brothers and sisters. It was actually, you know, it was just, you almost forgot the players were women. And that's almost like where we want to get to. It was just really good game of football and really great atmosphere in a crowd. And we all loved it and we'll probably all go again.
Mm. Oh, that's great. Right, so back to the theme then, politicians are behaving like children. There's a few to choose from. Is there any particular
I don't know why this is a theme now, because when has it not been the case that politicians have behaved like children? Present company accepted,
of course.
I hope. Well, what can we say? There's the kind of people who want to be prime minister, but who've never run a department, or if they have run a department, they've run it really badly, and they think that qualifies them. So there's a sort of immaturity that comes from a massive overestimation of your own ability. And I'm afraid that in politics that happens at all levels. There's people who are ambitious for their advancement beyond their capability to do anything. So there's a lot of that in politics.
So on other matters that are coming up, we have, of course, the B word. Which is going on
the Boris word or the Brexit one?
Brexit one.
Oh God!
So,
not again.
No, I was just going to say, what would your opinion on the implications for another independence referendum?
Well, I've consistently, as a member of the SNP Socialist campaign, specifically that we should both, as a party and the SNP, be in favour of a second EU referendum, and that it doesn't take away from the campaign for a second Indy referendum. I think the two strengthen each other. But more a point, I think it's important that we do give a damn about what happens to the rest of the UK. We now see that the Welsh government's now on side of, we're now going to campaign against Brexit. We need governments of various types in England to do the same, and whoever the government is, ideally we'd love a UK government that was actually against Brexit. Why not?
Yes.
But we have to convince the progressive majority of forces, which we now know that there is, from that EU election that the majority are now against Brexit. We know that Brexit will be damaging, therefore, you know, anything that we do that stops damage to our economy must be a good thing. But also it's the circumstances in which we would become independent. I think the idea that we could easily negotiate our exit from Britain with a chaotic exit by the British from the EU is for the birds. Yes. We want to stop that happening. But if it was to happen, we'd like to, you know, have an influence on how that process goes. So, I'm looking at it that I think obviously it's building support, and I know that from the doorstep campaign we did in the EU elections just gone. There's clear indications that people who voted Remain but no in 2014 have shifted towards yes. They're considering now independence as the only sane option because we're the only grown-up government involved in this in this country. We're the only one has a clear statement, clear political leadership on it, and clear majority for Remain, as we expressed in the rejection of what Farage and everybody has to stand for. We have to worry about the idea of Johnson or somebody like him becoming Prime Minister, because of course they'll go for the hardest possible Brexit to win a majority in England for the general election, which I think I've consistently predicted it would happen quite soon. I predicted it would happen all last year, thinking that Theresa May would put her deal to the country. And I was wrong about that, so I could be wrong about this. But I'm sure Boris has the hubris that he thinks he personally could win an election against Jeremy Corbyn like that. He will call one if he hasn't got a majority in Parliament for his former Brexit, and he won't have, because the arithmetic hasn't changed, therefore he's going to call an election, in my view.
Did anything happen in local politics in Glasgow or Scotland?
The most obvious one that's recent is the thing about the parades, processions, and the controversy around that. I'm of the view, and I've been consistently of the view, I talk about anti-Irish racism rather than sectarianism, because I don't see that the two things are equal on both sides here. The majority problem we have is with mostly loyalist sectarianism, and those are the marches that we have, and everybody who tells me or asks me about it always says that we hate having these marches go past our house. They go past my house, so I'm affected by it because I live in one of the routes. I'm not opposed to people having their civil rights to march. I mean, people have a misconception that the council can ban marches. We can't. You know, you have a right to do that. What we can say is we can vary a route. We can, you know, if there's trouble expected, like there was past that church where the priest was spat at, that gave us the reason to take the case to court. We've been trying for years to get a court case to make a judgment. And I'm delighted, frankly, that it's finally got to court and we've won that case. Now we've won that point in argument that we can order marches to avoid places. The reason for those marches, obviously historic, and some of them are much more controversial than others. Others don't pass churches or, you know, communities that don't want them. So, you know, I'm not in favour of banning them outright, but I'm certainly in favour of having less of them. Yes. And that I think we should change the rules in terms of how large they should be. I don't think it's a great use of our police resources and road closure plans to have marches of 20 people blocking off main roads. I'm staffed. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to have a review of the whole thing, but the current powers we have are very limited. So politically, I'm very glad that Call It Out exists, and I'm very glad that people are making their point, protesting against sectarian bigotry. We just have to be consistent then, applying the law to all groups in terms of marching and processing. One of the issues I've had directly is the case that came up of All Under One Banner. We had a very, very big independence march. It was great that it was so big, but the people organising it had no respect for the bylaws and did nothing to actually comply with applying for licences to use the parks or put proper toilet spaces in, have enough stewarding of the march. Now, if our side breaks the law, what do you think the other side is going to do? So I'd hope that people learn that lesson, that actually it's important that we abide by what rules there are. And if the law needs changing to make the rules more solid, great, but they can't prevent freedom of speech and the right of assembly. So people have to be clear. We don't have the power to do that, and we should not have the power to do that.
Is there anything you can update us on in the work you've been doing for
reparations?
For reparatives. Is there anything you can update us on the work you've been doing for
Reparative.
Reparative justice.
Yes, there is. I've been working with, I did a visit to a place called Dollar Academy, which is a quite well-known private school, but set up by a man who had slavery plantations in Jamaica. And their school, and their deputy rector, the deputy head teacher, have been involving us, myself, Jeff Palmer, and Lisa Williams from the Edinburgh Caribbean Association. We went and visited them and had begun a partnership with them on them trying to redress their slavery legacy. And they're going to do a sort of mini version of what Glasgow Uni did last year, which we were involved with, which involved having an academic look through the files, study the donations for the building of the Glasgow University campus at Gilmore Hill, and look to where that origins of that money came from. And that resulted in this big headline that £200 million worth of in today's money came from slave owners to build that building. Yeah. So that led to other institutions and universities doing the same thing. It's led to this school beginning the same process. They've agreed to put a historian in place for a few months and come with a report that will go to their board of governors. So we're getting schools starting to do this. I'm hoping that schools like Bathgate Academy, similarly set up by Mr. Newlands, just this week it was the Newlands Festival in Bathgate. Right. And they celebrate the slave-owning guy who owned the big plantation near to Kingston. Yes. You know, so this is a bunch of people that need to follow Dollar Academy's example. So I'm working on that side of it. But also I'm on two committees. One is a museum committee, which is organised by the Coalition for Racial Equality and Rights. We're supposed to meet this week. We will meet soon. But that will continue the campaign for this online resource that we launched in March, which is a sort of online museum, if you like. Mm. And it's got educational resources and historical accounts. So all those are there. So Crea's museum committee is ongoing. But in addition to that, I'm now to convene a sort of subgroup within the council to basically start working on what we want to do for Black History Month and how we're going to involve working with the BME community, but particularly the African Caribbean community, to co-author what we're going to do in terms of our reparative justice effort, because that's about our museums being clear about what their strategy will be. It'll be about what education resources we put out there and also what to say and input the community is going to have. So all of these things are up for grabs now, and I've been given, not carte blanche, but I can say I've been given some responsibility to put that committee together. So there will be some news. I can't say it just yet, but there's some very interesting things that are going to happen in October.
All right, excellent. Well, I'm sure you'll let us know about all that any come the time. Right, is there anything else that you'd like to talk about at the moment?
Well, since I last seen you, I've seen you since party conference, haven't I? So the whole...
Yes.
Growth permission thing was happening just before that. I think the climate emergency, I've just today been with five schools doing a thing called the Walk, Walk the Global Walk. It's an international day of action of students in 11 European countries, started by the UNESCO, I think it is, or the Oxfam in Florence in Italy. They were the starters of this, and Glasgow schools have been part of it, and basically did a walk through the park and a day's training about environmental activism. So today we were looking for solutions around, you know, they were asking me questions and the convener of education questions. What are we going to do? What is the council doing? And we asked some of them if they'd been on strike on the Fridays, and some of them gingerly put their hand up, and we said, well, do you know what, we very much approve of that, because we think in an afternoon's social exterior experimenting with civic governance and public affairs, you're going to learn a lot more in that afternoon in George Square than you'll learn in quite a few hours in the classroom. So we think that's a good thing, as long as you're not doing it every week. But yes, it was interesting just to have that conversation with them and looking at the solutions they come up with. So I'm quite clear that the climate emergency needs to be an emergency response. So, you know, if we say it's an emergency, which we've voted through last month, we've now got to treat that as an emergency with some actions which require some real changes, step changes in how we use vehicles, how we use energy, how we use our buildings, what provisions we make for road closures and pedestrianisation, what public transport we're going to provide, all of these. So there should be some new recommendations coming out of this climate committee that was commissioned after the IPCC report last year in October. So that committee is due to report back. It includes Instinction, Rebellion and Friends of the Earth and various other people, as well as the councillors. So that will report back in the end of this month and report its conclusions and recommendations for us to take short-term action to make our target a bit more sooner. So I'm really quite pleased that subject is being given a bit more gravitas and yes. importance, and it will impact upon all sorts of areas of work that we do.
Thank you very much.
Macred keeps us going. Donate at paypal.me/ungagged left.